And welcome back to Fully Equipped. Tim Breon here from True Spec Golf, joined by John Wall from golf.com. What's up, John?
Hey, what's going on, Professor Breon?
Where are we speaking to you from this week, John?
I'm off the road.
You're home and I'm home?
I know. We should probably go out and buy some lotto tickets. This almost never happens for us to both be off the road. But yeah, it's nice to get another week to work on some more content here at the house and not have to be in Atlanta. Although I do love East Lake. Last week, as we kind of talked about, was pretty chaotic with all the what's in the bag shoots at Medina. So it is nice to have a little bit of downtime. But I'm sure you're pretty busy even though you're at home.
Yeah, it never ends. Just trying to figure out ways to hit this white ball a little bit better. And hopefully all of our listeners as well. So who's your pick this week out at East Lake? I'd be curious to hear that.
I mean, it's got to be Justin Thomas. With this new format that they have for the Tour Championship, where the leader gets staked with a two-shot lead, anytime you're staking Justin Thomas, the way he's playing and the way that he plays at East Lake, one of his favorite courses with a two-shot lead, I think it's pretty much... I'm not going to say it's a done deal, but it's pretty darn close when you give a guy of that caliber a two-shot lead before a ball's even struck on Thursday. What about you?
Yeah, I have to agree with you wholeheartedly here. Spotting a world-class player like him two shots to start the day, or to start the week, rather, that's we see where somebody improves their scoring average 0.2 strokes per round, and it has a huge effect over their cumulative showings throughout the year. So spotting somebody off on one week with two shots, especially with as well as he played last week, and we all know that there aren't very many guys on tour that can go as low as he can from week to week, around and around. So it's going to be a hard player to beat. So
we're both picking the chalk, which means we're pretty boring guys, Tim.
Pretty boring, and it means there's no way he wins.
Exactly. I was about to say we are the ultimate jinxes, which means, hey, sorry JT, you're probably not going to be winning the FedEx Cup.
Yeah, and you better have a backup driver if John Wall picks you. So in any event, let's get into our topics for discussion this week. Why don't you tee up for our listeners what we're going to be chatting about?
Yep. So we're going to get into Victor Hovland, who for the third time in six starts has switched irons, which is pretty incredible for a guy who's chasing his card. Also discuss Patrick Reed, who took Webb Simpson's advice and switched golf balls and ended up using the ball that Webb suggested to win the Northern Trust. Gonna get headlong now into the product launch season. I think it's worth the two of us talking about what products are we most excited about that'll be coming out for 2020. Club of the week. I really want to get your thoughts on Justin Thomas's T100 4-iron. I've got a pretty cool story about it. And then get into some pod questions. Got a couple of good ones. And then finally get into the second half of our interview with Bob Bettinardi.
Sounds like a great week, man. And just to start us off with Victor, what can you tell us about his setup for last week?
Well, I think if I've learned anything, Tim, from the first six starts of Victor Hovland's pro career, it's that he doesn't mind making equipment changes. At previous pods, we've talked about at the U.S. Open, he put in a brand new split set of Ping iBlade and i210 irons and a new Ping G410 LST driver, probably less than 24 hours before his first round tee time at the U.S. Open. Since then, he's kept the driver in play, but he's actually been kind of tinkering with his iron setup. So he started with iBlade, i210, a split set, iBlade in the 4-6, i210 in the 7-pitch. Then more recently switched to a full set of the i210s. You and I discussed that a little bit just because, that's not your typical tour pro set of irons, a little bit more on the forgiving side. And then right after we discuss it, Victor decides to throw us a curveball and he switches back to iBlade in the 4-6, but the new Blueprint, the smaller, looks more like a muscle back version of Ping's irons in the 7-pitching wedge. So with that, Tim, what do you think we should expect from Victor Hovland? Are you thinking he's going to be making a change this week in Boise? I mean, what's your take on a guy who's gone through three different sets of irons in his first six starts?
It's very unusual to see a tour player change equipment as frequently. And not just change it frequently, you see this all the time where they'll test equipment, but it doesn't make its way into the bag for the event. So that's why it's even more rare to see somebody switch as frequently and actually get it in the bag to play in the event. From that perspective, it's rare to see this. But I think it's important that we all understand, you know, Victor is still getting used to the general looks and performance characteristics of the Ping products that he's playing. He didn't play Ping products throughout his collegiate career. I believe he played TaylorMade, right, John?
You're right, he did. Yep, he played TaylorMade.
And I believe he had a pretty decent history with TaylorMade product at some level in his bag throughout his amateur and development career. So when you see a player switch, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a sign of bad things to come. Not the case at all. But he hasn't built up that comfort and familiarity with the product yet because, you know, he hasn't used it for years and years and years. When you talk about design concepts specific to certain brands, of course, every brand has different products that will, you know, characteristically play well for certain types of players. But there are general design concepts of whether they're more of a, you know, distance brand or whether they're more of an aesthetics and feel brand or whether they're more of a forgiveness brand or if they tend to help players hit it higher or lower. So I would say that brands tend to take on general profiles for performance characteristics. And so when you're used to certain performance characteristics out of, you know, a brand that you've worked with for many years and then you transition to a different brand, there's probably going to be a learning curve. I know the last couple of episodes of the pod, we were talking about the I210s and how we may see that there are more perimeter-weighted clubs going in play with tour pros, you know, throughout all the different tours, obviously.
I think Victor listened to that podcast, Tim. I think
he must
listened
have.
To that podcast and just decided to go in opposite direction.
Yeah, it's always the way it seems to work, right? But where does he end up? I think it probably ends up with a split bag. I think you're going to look at, you know, players, clubs, you know, whether it be the Blueprint or the iBlade series in the scoring irons and then transition into some sort of perimeter weighting in the long irons. This is a bag setup that we're seeing on a lot of players these days where they are, you know, putting clubs in play at the top end of the bag for their long irons that are a little more forgiving. So that's where I think it probably ends up. That being said, you know, obviously we've not seemed to be able to hone in on exactly where this is going yet for Victor. But, you know, my bet would be you're going to see players' clubs in the scoring irons and cavity backs in the long irons. So
yeah, no, I'm with you. I think that actually this iBlade Blueprint setup that he started using last week in the Korn Ferry Tour Finals is probably going to be pretty close to what he's going to be using going forward. And I agree with you. I think something a little bit more forgiving in the cavity back version for the long irons and something with a smaller, more compact profile, the Blueprint that allows him to work the ball both ways, you know, varies his launch. So I think this will be pretty close. Okay, now let's just say this. Do you think he stays with this setup in Boise or do you think he goes to something else?
I would think that he's going to reach some level of stability here in the near future. I've never heard of a tour pro switching into four different sets of irons in 7 weeks. So I would think that we're probably going to reach a point of stability in the very near term future. I'm going to go with no. I think that this set will stay in play for at least a few events, get him through the Korn Ferry Finals and see where that ends up with as far as status for next year. And then obviously he's going to have a few weeks to really dial stuff in. Once, you know, the off season. I don't even know what the off season is anymore.
There is no off season, Tim. There is no off season.
The off season, I think, is the Tuesday after the last event, and that's about the whole off season. So,
yeah.
But either way, he'll get some time to dial this stuff in before the end of the year, you know, through the holiday break. And I would be shocked if we see this much instability in Victor's bag setup going into, you know, next year. But from now for the next couple weeks, he'll probably tinker a little bit more and then settle on something that he's going to work with through the off season.
No, I'm with you. All right, so let's switch gears, going from golf clubs to golf ball, and this is actually a fairly interesting story, Tim, that I heard. Patrick Reed won the Northern Trust. He played really well that week, obviously, you know, and this is a guy who won for the first time since his 2018 Masters. He had struggled a little bit. And had been using Titleist's Pro V1 Left Dot. Now, for people out there that aren't really into all the different types of versions of the Pro V1, there are more versions than just the standard Pro V1 and Pro V1X that you can find at your local golf shop. There are slight variations, mostly to do with launch and spin that are offered to tour players that the average golfer can't get access to. But again, you know, we're talking tour players here. So Patrick was using the Pro V1 Lefdaw, which has a little bit of a lower launch and less spin than the standard Pro V1, but had actually been noticing that those launch and spin characteristics were causing him a little bit of trouble with his scoring clubs. So he was playing with Webb Simpson at the event prior to the Northern Trust at the Wyndham. And Webb suggested to him that he go back to the 2017 version of the Pro V1. It was actually a ball that Webb said would probably help him get that launch and spin that he was trying to get to help with his short irons. And lo and behold, Webb offered up a dozen golf balls to Patrick Reed for him to use. Patrick used it on Sunday at Wyndham, goes out and shoots 7 under during the final round, and then the following week goes on to win the Northern Trust. You know, I hope Patrick sent some sort of a gift to Webb Simpson for throwing that suggestion out there about the golf ball. But you know, I think this brings up a really good point for a lot of listeners out there, because again, going back to what I said earlier, you know, not everybody knows that there are different versions of the Pro V1. I think everybody just assumes that tour players, when the new golf ball comes out, that's the version they're playing. And while a lot of tour players do play the new version, there are some that, again, tour players being creatures of habit, they find certain characteristics with a golf ball that keeps them in that version going forward. So not all pros are using the most recent version. Doesn't mean that the new version isn't good, but when we're talking about the best players in the world, you know, again, if they find something that works, they're going to stick with it. And I think this goes back to a story, Tim, that I told to you off here that I absolutely love. Years ago, I remember watching Luke Donald on the range, and his caddy had a shag bag. He was probably about 100 yards out off the side of the range. And Luke was, you know, again, being one of the best wedge players in the world, was just hitting little 100-yard wedge shots just to the feet of his caddy. And when he finished up with the balls, his caddy would pick them all up. And I was curious to know, why was he using a shag bag to pick up range balls? Well, they weren't range balls. Luke was using an older version of the Pro V1. It was so old that Luke had a stockpile of these balls to hit on the practice range because they just didn't have any more of them. So that was his way of being able to work on his short game when he was on the range. But again, going back to Patrick Reed, I think this just goes to show you that sometimes, even though, you know, people see a Pro V1 as a Pro V1, there are subtle differences that can be a huge benefit, especially to tour players.
Yeah, and that's a great point. There are two things that I take away from that little story. The first one being that, exactly as you mentioned, there are different versions of balls available for the tour pros out there. You know, you look at what Nike had in marketplace a couple years back. The versions that Rory and Tiger played were very different than the retail versions. You know, most players in today's age are looking to eliminate spin, and they're looking for low spin balls. It's been interesting to me that when you look at the super elite players, I mean the best of the best, there is a contingency of players that actually looks for the most spinny golf ball they can find. The idea there being that they're going to use technique and skill to take spin off the ball. They don't want the equipment to limit what they have available to them. And obviously, when you're talking about spin, it doesn't just mean backspin, but backspin also creates height. When you start to, you know, swing at it from different angles with different club face angles, then that backspin becomes quote-unquote side spin. You know, side spin doesn't really exist. It's just backspin on a tilt, so to speak. But when you're looking at the spin rate of the ball, the amount that the ball curves, the amount that it checks, the height that it flies, all have to do with how much the ball is spinning. So when you look at some of the super elite players out there, they're actually biasing their ball selection more towards the spinnier golf balls because it's going to allow them to do more things with the types of shots they want to hit. So that's one interesting takeaway. And that parlays into a second point to make along that line, which is for any folks that are out there that are fitting their golf balls to their driver, specifically their driver and their long clubs, keep in mind that the club that you're striking the ball the most frequently with is actually your putter. If you don't think that ball fitting matters for a putter, and I'm not going to go down the putter rabbit hole this week, I promise, John. But
oh, man, here we go. I was about to say, we're about to get Professor Breon on his soapbox. Here
yeah,
we go.
But if you think that any ball will do when it comes to putting, go out there and play with a ball that's, you know, extremely hard distance two-piece ball, and then go out there and try to putt with something that's very, very soft. Just the acoustics are different. The feel off the putter face is different. So the bottom line is that the ball does matter for putting, and you have certain expectations for the way the ball is going to come off the face of your putter, whether you like it to feel a little soft and slower or where you want it to come off with a little more speed. But that can't be disconnected from what the ball and face interaction are going to give you. So, you know, and then when you look at wedges, the ability to stop a ball on a dime, if you're a player that plays a lot of bump and run shots that have a lot of rollout, you probably don't want a ball that checks up very much. And conversely, if you're playing a lot of flop shots or pitch shots that, you know, take one stop and or one hop and stop, you probably want something that is going to check. So I would advise the average golfers that are out there listening, bias your ball selection on your scoring clubs. And when you get it down to two or three models of golf ball that you seem to really chip and putt well with, then that's when you want to consider how that performs with the driver and the irons. Base it on the short game, and then when you have to split hairs between two options that are really good for your short game, use the long game performance as the determining factor. So that's one piece of advice there in ball selection. Obviously, Patrick was
That's the best piece of advice.
Yeah.
That's the best piece of advice, Tim, to be quite honest. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
But seriously, I mean, from all of the, I mean, I shouldn't say all, but a lot of the tour pros that I talk to, when I talk to them about testing, the one in particular that sticks out to me is Tiger Woods. These guys always start with the short game.
Yep.
You know, and I don't think most would ever consider starting with the putter, but particularly the wedges, you always hear players talk about starting with little pitch chip shots around the green and
yep.
then kind of working their way out from there. So no, I think that's a great piece of advice for the amateur golfers out there.
It's the length of shot that really is the most dependent upon consistent spin. When you're talking about 50, 60, 70, 80 yard pitch shots, you're not using a full swing, so your club head speed is not as high as it normally would be. But those types of shots, you still need them to stop when they hit the green fairly quickly. So how do you generate the necessary spin to stop the ball with only swinging at it half speed? A lot of that is through the proper technique and setup, but a lot of it also does have to do with the grooves you have on your wedge, the type of material your wedge is, and the type of golf ball and the way that all this interacts together. So definitely consider, you know, wedge performance, putter performance when you're looking at golf balls, and then use the long game as the tiebreaker. That brings me into the second point here regarding the ball switch that a lot of folks may not be aware of, but tour players actually treat the golf ball almost like it's vintages of wine. You know, I remember the 2009 Pro V, I believe it was the regular Pro V, almost had like a cult following with a few different players.
And I think it had some earthy tones to it, Tim.
Yeah, right? So, yes. Exactly. I mean, you would never expect that, right? That they look at, oh, don't give me that 2008 ball. Give me that 2007 one. That one's much better. To the average golfer out there, they may not understand that there are little nuances and differences of the way that they're designed. Maybe the mantle or the core or the cover was a half a millimeter thicker here or thinner there. And what that ends up producing is a ball flight that maybe goes a half a degree higher as far as launch angle and maybe spins 200 RPMs more. It's always fun this time of year to be out at a golf course where a lot of tour players frequent, and you see a lot of white, non-logoed, non-copy. I mean, there's nothing on these boxes of balls, and they have these white boxes of balls out that are all the prototypes that they're testing. And, you know, these guys are like kids in candy stores, too, when they get the new golf balls to test in their practice rounds, trying to figure out what's different this year versus last year. But not all Pro Vs are created equal. The boxes that you see in the stores, there could be some differences between the way that those are being produced and the performance characteristics compared to the ball that your favorite player may be playing out there. Bottom line is never pick a ball based upon something that another player is playing. Pick a ball based upon, you know, what is going to help you get the ball in the hole faster. Pick one that's going to help your putting and your chipping and your short game and your pitching, something that's not going to undermine your long game. That's the best way to pick the right ball for you. And I would say that it's probably one of the most important things in any sort of fitting process to consider. It's the only piece of equipment that you're using for every single shot you hit. So make sure that you've got the right one in play, because it could definitely impact your scoring.
Some wonderful pearls of wisdom there from Professor Briant. All right, let's get into talking about product launch season. We are almost there, Tim. We're almost to that point where everybody's going to start. All the major OEMs will start releasing new products for 2020. And I'm curious, what club are you most looking forward to checking out as we kind of get in, as I said, into that launch season?
So I'd have to say probably the MP20 line from Mizuno. Mizuno has been, you know, a major player in the game when it came to irons and wedges for a long time, especially irons. Some would say that their early, you know, 1990s, late 80s designs have kind of stood the test of time, whether it's the MP29 and then the MP67. So to see Mizuno carry that legacy forward with their iron design, I think is going to be really interesting for me to see how it relates to the MP18 series. What are the differences? Does it look and feel similar to some of the iconic product lines that they've produced in the past? So for me, it would probably be the Mizuno MP20 line. What about you, John?
You know, I'm going to go more generic and just say the drivers. You know, I would argue we've sort of hit the ceiling with driver distance. We've seen in recent years a lot more adjustability, improvements to sound with the carbon composite crowns. You know, we saw with TaylorMade's drivers with twist face trying to really tighten up those misses. I want to know where we're going to be going from here. You know, again, we haven't seen a whole lot about distance now. It's been more about improving other areas of the driver. So I'm really excited to see what everybody's bringing out and what the hot new product is out there. You know, last season, it seemed to be Callaway and their flash face technology, which was a brand new kind of a breakthrough technology in the industry. But yeah, you know, I'm really, really interested to see what the newest tech is for the drivers, because again, it doesn't seem to be distance anymore. It seems to be other areas.
Yeah. I think where you're going to see a lot of focus for driver designers isn't necessarily top end distance out of the middle of the face. They know they're getting very close to the limitation of where they can go with that. Obviously, there may be some breakthrough materials, but I mean, at the end of the day, the CT limitation is the CT limitation. And if we're already maxed out against that CT limitation, where does it go from here? I think what you're going to see more of is designers figuring out ways to get maximum ball speed when you don't hit it in the middle of the face. Now, there's an argument to be had there. Is that really a good thing? If I'm hitting it 2 centimeters off the toe, hitting it, you know, 10 degrees offline, do I really want that thing to go 320 yards into a swimming pool? Or would I rather it go 60 yards shorter and stay on the golf course? But I think that that's where a lot of club designers are going to focusing out of the ball speeds off the center of the face, as well as technologies that help the ball correct for errant shots. So if you come in with the club face really far open or really far closed, is there something that they can do with bulge and roll and gear effect and everything else to help, you know, enhance that for certain players? You look at twist face with TaylorMade, that's what that technology was targeting. When you look at flash face from Callaway, that was more targeting getting a faster ball speed across the entire face. So you look at the kind of the leaders in driver design in the marketplace, along with your Pings and Titleists out there, and they're focusing more on trying to get speed across the face and helping players when they don't hit it in the middle, don't hit it as far offline. So, which segues perfectly into a new set of products that has just released from Titleist, which is their T-Series irons. I think you've got a equipment spotlight for the week that will be interesting to our listeners.
Yeah, you know, so Justin Thomas won last week's BMW Championship, and he only had one new addition to the bag, which was a Titleist T100, which is going to be the replacement for the AP2, the T100 4 iron. And I actually found out that Justin had kind of admitted to the Titleist tour reps that he just had never really found a 4 iron of all clubs. And again, this is the difference between a regular golfer and a tour player. He hadn't ever really found a 4 iron that he was comfortable with. And so he actually had tested Titleist's T100 at Muirfield during the week of the Memorial. They had an off-site shoot at Scioto. And Justin loved it so much, he wanted to put it in the bag before launch, and they actually had to hold him back and tell him, hey, we can't. It's not on the list yet. The conforming list is what I mean by list. And so Justin actually kind of at his urging moved up the launch of the T-Series to the U.S. Open, and Justin actually was kind of the impetus for the moving up of the T.S. Woods launch to the U.S. Open last year. So Justin clearly has a lot of pull when it comes to moving up tour launches. But But yeah, it seems like he found a new four iron that he really likes. It helped add a little bit more consistency during testing. You know, he's not looking for more distance with a four iron. He's looking to hit his number with every club in the bag. That's one of the reasons why he plays a set of blades. Again, he's looking for more consistency here. But, you know, where he finds his consistency, Tim, with this new four iron, I believe, comes from this dual density tungsten that Titleist positions in the heel and toe of each club. There's 66 grams on average in each head, which is more than what was found in 718 AP2. And oh, by the way, T100 is more compact and has a more svelte profile than 718 AP2, which is still kind of a modern marvel that they're able to do these things with tungsten while still keeping that compact profile. And in kind of positioning that tungsten in the heel and the toe, it's designed to enhance the stability at impact. That's one of the wonderful things about tungsten. I mean, have you had a chance yet, Tim? I'm curious. You know, now, I mean, obviously Justin has it because he's a tour pro, but have you had a chance to hit any of the new T-Series irons?
They're really excellent. You know, Titleist for many years was considered one of the best iron design houses in the industry. My favorite set of irons I've ever played was a set of 962Bs way back in the day. As a matter of fact, when I was leaving...
Those were good ones.
Yeah, they were some of the best. I remember when I was leaving college, I asked my coach to get me a couple extra backup sets just because I knew they wouldn't be made much longer. They were so good. And then they obviously transitioned into, you know, 755s. We talked about Stricker putting them in play. The 790, they've had a bunch of different irons over the last 20 years that have really been industry leaders. And what ended up happening about 10 years ago is some of the brands started to catch up. When you look at, you know, TaylorMade and some of their iron design concepts, Callaway as well, they started to enhance the tech packages that were available in these products. And Titleist always had an edge when it came to look and feel. But there wasn't a lot of tech that went into their products going back 10 or 15 years. It was more of a traditionalist product line. And when they started to get eclipsed by the TaylorMades and Callaways of the world, I think it made them say, wait a minute, it's not just about looks and feel anymore when you're talking irons. We need to get some tech in here that's going to help players play better. And so when you look at the new T-Series irons, as we spoke with Stephanie Luttrell a couple weeks back, a lot of the design concepts that they have now carried forward into their T-Series of irons were design concepts that they tinkered around with their concept irons. So they're using their different franchises of clubs to help them springboard off of those designs into future designs, which is what you would expect. But everything I've seen so far out of the T-Series of irons from Titleist is amazing. For all you Titleist loyalists out there, you're going to love these products. They look like a Titleist. They feel like a Titleist. But they're going to get you a little bit more ball speed. They're going to get you a little bit better flight characteristics, a little bit more consistency and forgiveness. So high hopes for all of those irons in the marketplace. And I think all the different tour staff that uses them will use them very effectively. As far as the product launch being moved up, that definitely explains it. We were supposed to do a little seminar and talk about club fitting to a bunch of PGA professionals and ended up getting my travel plans completely upended because they moved up the product launch. Now I know it's because of Justin. So if I bump into him, I'll...
Thanks a lot, JT.
Yeah, thanks a lot for screwing up my August. But in any event... In any event, it's very for somebody that's playing muscleback blades throughout a lot of the set. I think you're going to see a lot of the long iron setups, whether it's, you know, utility irons, long irons. You know, when Tiger's using a perimeter weighted, you know, driving iron, the fact is that when you're talking about three irons and two irons, not even the best ball strikers in the world are trying to play muscleback blades. You know, one of the only guys I know that's playing a muscle back blade in the two iron these days is probably Gary Woodland and maybe a couple other guys, but it's few and far between. So we're starting to see a little bit of that transition over the last few years into more forgiving product, because the forgiving product that's available these days still maintains those performance characteristics that some of those muscle back blades had, you know, back in the day. So be curious to see where all this goes. But that's some great intel in the field there, John, on the Justin Thomas four iron edition. Obviously, he used it pretty well last week.
Yeah, pretty decent. I think he probably could have played with one hand behind his back and still won the way that he was hitting that golf ball.
Good Good stuff. Well, I think that leads us into mailbag for the week. What questions do our listeners need to have answered?
We got a couple of good ones, actually. One that I need you to answer, which is this first question here. It may or may not pertain to my game. Golf Daydreamer asked, can you explain draw settings on a driver? How exactly will they help me eliminate my slice?
Wow. So there are a couple of different design features for golf clubs that will make a driver, quote-unquote, draw biased. The first one that's easy to talk about would be the adjustable loft settings that you have. Most of the companies do not have what's called a decoupled adapter system. A decoupled adapter system like Callaway's means that when you adjust the loft of the face, the only factor you're adjusting is loft. You're not also adjusting face angle or lie angle. For most of the adapter tips that are available out there, when you adjust one factor, you're by default also adjusting the other factors. So for like a TaylorMade tip, for instance, when you raise the loft on your adapter sleeve, you're actually also closing the face and you're changing the lie angle slightly. Some of these adapter settings have upright settings. Whenever you see upright, think draw. So the way that they're doing that is through lie angle and face angle. They're either actually physically closing the face of the club a degree or 2 degrees. For every 1 degree of loft, you're changing the face angle almost 2 degrees. So if you have a 9.5 degree driver and you turn it into a 10.5 through the little adjustable sleeve at the bottom, you're actually closing the face almost 2 degrees when you do that. I know it's a little counterintuitive that when you close the face, you add loft, but this is something that a lot of amateurs tend to have a hard time with because they're used to opening the face on their wedge, and when they open the face on their wedge, that adds loft. Well, it works a little differently when you're talking about the adjustability sleeves. So remember, if you're closing the face, you're adding loft, and if you're opening the face, you're negating loft. You're also adjusting lie angle. So that's how the adjustable loft sleeves work. They work to enhance draw benefits by either closing the face or making the club more upright, so the toe of the club is more up in the air at impact and you have a lie angle that points the face more over to the left for a right-handed golfer. The other thing that you're going to look at in club design is weighting. So anything that allows for adjustable weighting, specifically heel to toe. If you're adjusting weighting from front to back, that can have an influence over draw versus fade biases. Usually when the weighting is more forward towards the face, you get more fade bias. When the weighting is more back towards the back of the club or the trailing edge of the club, you get more draw bias. But it's usually minimal. What really tends to affect it is when you can move the weighting from heel to toe. So anytime you move the weighting more towards the toe, that's going to cause the shaft to droop more. And it's also going to cause the CG to be more biased towards the toe, which could make a player tend to want to strike the ball more towards the toe of the face because they get more solid contact. But it's also going to affect gear effect. Gear effect is that funny little factor that when you hit a ball on the toe, it hooks. When you hit a ball on the heel, it fades. The same thing exists vertically. So if you hit a ball low on the face, like if you're hitting a ball off of a cart path, those will usually spin a lot because you're hitting the ball very low on the face. And then think about when you're hitting the ball out of rough. Usually when you're hitting it out of the rough, the ball doesn't spin at all. And think about where that ball hits on the face. It hits higher than the sweet spot. So the strike location of where the ball hits on the face can impact a lot of the spin characteristics. And it's a little counterintuitive that when you hit it on the toe, it draws. When you hit it on the heel, it fades. But the bottom line here is by moving that weight from heel to toe, you're adjusting some of those design properties, and I call them the inertial properties of the club. You're changing a little of the MOI and the way the CG is structured around the head. Now, it's important to mention that you're not changing it by much. It's not like you're changing, you know, when you slide that weight port on an Epic Flash driver from the extreme heel to the extreme toe, it's not like you're changing the CG many inches. You may be only changing it a few millimeters, but that has a compound effect through the performance of the club because it's going to change how the shaft tends to bend. It's going to change a lot of the gear effect properties. It's going to change where the hottest place on the face could be. So it kind of has a compound effect when you change the CG just a couple of millimeters. But that, in general, is the way that the draw bias for golf clubs works. It's either a weight play or it's an adjustability play in the angle of the face or the lie angle.
And it's also important to note, Tim, that not only can you find adjustable drivers now that have a draw setting in them, but there are now draw bias drivers out on the market too, like TaylorMade's M6 D-Type that has 46 grams of weight packed into that heel. It's gonna really bend a lot more than the standard M6. So there are multiple ways now. If you don't feel comfortable adjusting the driver yourself, a lot of the manufacturers now are now offering a draw bias version that already has that setup already built in, so that when you set it down, you just have to hit it and go.
Yeah, a lot of players don't like looking down at a closed face, even though a closed face may benefit their game. It's kind of a thing that filters down from the pyramid of influence with tour players. A lot of amateur golfers will read stories about tour players that don't like a closed-looking face, and then they think, oh, well, I must not like that either. In reality, for a lot of players, especially ones that tend to block, push, slice, or fade the ball, a slightly more closed face would actually benefit them, but they've built in this aesthetic preference to not look at a closed face. So then how do you give them something that is a little different from a performance sake that's going to have more draw bias but not look draw bias? And the way they do that when you're talking metal woods is exactly what you said on the D-Type, is they put a lot of mass in on the heel of the club. And by moving all that mass in towards the heel, it creates a little bit more draw bias just based upon gear effect and some of those. And I can tell you from our own independent testing at TruSpec, these draw-type products, they work. They are very effective. We've seen up to a 25-yard delta or differential between the standard product and the draw product on a robot, and 25 yards.
Which is wild.
Yeah, that's huge. So, you know, when you're talking about on a robot having 20 yards of differential between directional tendencies, that's huge. And so, you know, if you are a player that tends to fade it a lot and you're tired of looking at that slice, try one of these more draw-based products. It may help. Be aware, though, that your slice may turn into a pull. So you may start missing a lot of targets left of target because you're used to playing a slice that is no longer there. But test it out, see how it works for you, because you may find it may help your game.
I'll take a pull over a slice any day of the week.
Me too, man, me too. The minute that ball starts carving right, you know, I'm a righty, so the minute it starts carving right with a really weak ball flight, it bugs me. I would have to say I'll prefer that high slice to a low pull hook. You know, anything that's a low pull hook, I pretty much want to walk off the golf course right away. Not that you've ever hit a hook in your entire career, John.
I hit hooks in my sleep, so don't worry. I've got that shot down, yeah. Pat. All right, next question is from Noah. I'm gonna guess Noah C. Erickson, but maybe his last name is Sarrickson. What are the differences between TaylorMade's Twist Face and Callaway's Flash Face? They are not even close to the same thing, Tim.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think a lot of average golfers out there will hear the word face and think that there's some similarities there. But the design concept is they're both targeting two completely different, you know, problems, so to speak. So one of the things about twist face, when you look at the design of any metal wood, anything that you're putting a head cover on, and you look at the face of the club, unlike the irons, the face of the club is not perfectly flat. It has curve in it. That's called bulge and roll. So when you look at it from the top, you're going to notice that the middle of the face kind of bulges out. When you get to the toe and the heel, they kind of recede back away. When you look at the product from the vertical perspective, you're going to notice that the middle of the face bulges out, and then towards the top by the crown and the bottom by the sole, that you'll notice that they kind of roll back. This is a design characteristic, specifically in metal woods, that's designed to help you from hooking or slicing the ball too much. Like we just mentioned a few minutes back regarding bulge and roll, when you hit a ball on the toe, the ball will tend to hook due to physics. So what designers have done is when they go out onto the toe section of a metal wood, they actually make that toe section of the face more open than the middle of the face. Reason being, if the face is more open out on the toe, you're not going to get as much hook spin. So it's a way to mitigate gear effect. When you're looking at twist face, what TaylorMade did is they looked at all this different data from all these shots that players hit. And what they found is that for two specific locations on the club face, that players tended to be over penalized by gear effect. Specifically, when they hit a ball high and on the toe, the ball tended to hook too much. And when they hit the ball low and on the heel, it tended to fade too much. So the idea was, instead of taking a symmetrical approach to bulge and roll, where the same amount of roll in the toe exists on the toe and the heel, they took an asymmetrical approach to the way that they were going to put the curvature in that face. And what you'll see in a twist face product is when you get out onto the high toe section of the club, that face of the club rolls a lot more, or it recedes a lot more away from the center of the face. And then when you look at the heel section of the club, it recedes a lot less. So what all of these factors did overall is it means that when you hit it low and on the heel, it'll be less fade biased. When you hit it high and on the toe, it'll be less hook biased. So this is kind of a directional play. That's what they're trying to solve for. How do we get the golfer to hit it straighter when they don't hit it in the center of the club? When you look at Epic Flash and Flash Face, completely different design concept. What they did there is they used machine learning or artificial intelligence, and they put in all these different parameters of data of this is where all these different players hit shots on the face of the club. And based upon all these different attack angles, speeds, club face angles, strike locations, it crunched all these numbers in a supercomputer, and the supercomputer came up with a design for the thickness of the face. We'll get into this in another episode, I'm sure, when you talk about variable face thickness. But when you look at the face of a driver, it's actually not uniform throughout the entire face. The center of the driver in most designs is actually the thickest part of the face, and then the perimeters tend to be the thinnest. With Epic Flash, that general convention has been thrown out the window. As a matter of fact, you know, speaking to all the designers over at Callaway, the first iteration they saw of Flash Face, they thought that they were all going to get fired because they looked at this thing and they said, this does not look normal. I think we just screwed up. There's no way this is going to work. And lo and behold, it does work, and it works extremely well. So what the idea here is by going to a conventional protocol as far as the thickness of the face, where you make the face the thickest in the center and the thinnest in the perimeter, it's completely, it's almost amorphous. It's asymmetrical. If you looked at the actual face, the only thing I can tell our listeners is Google it. Go look it up on the internet and look up Epic Flash Face and compare that to some of the other faces that have been designed. And what you're going to notice is that the backside of that face almost looks like the texture of water when you throw a pebble into it, where it just has a bunch of ripples that don't really have any rhyme or reason to them. And what they're doing there is they're playing with the thickness of the face to enhance ball speed across the entire face. So when you don't hit it in the center, how do we make a ball that's being hit a centimeter towards the toe go faster, closer to what it does in the center? What they came up with was Epic Flash or Flash Face technology, AI Flash Face. So one is more of a directional play. One is more of a distance play on off-center hits. So very different problems that they were trying to solve for. And I think, you know, obviously this applies to different golfers. If you're somebody who hits it off the center of the face and you're trying to figure out a way to keep it on the golf course, maybe twist face is worth exploring. If you're somebody that notices that when you hit it off the center of the face, you lose 40 yards in distance, maybe you want to go out and try an Epic Flash. But that's the differences. I hope that helps explain a little bit and doesn't make it more confusing.
Hey, Tim, quick question. Do you know how many iterations of driver face design that supercomputer went through before it came up with the optimal configuration?
I don't know, but I know that it didn't come up with, it wasn't like it had to go through this for months and months and months.
15,000.
Oh, was it really?
15,000.
15,000 is what they told
15, you? 15,000 iterations.
Here's the crazy thing too. That supercomputer can rip through 15,000 iterations in probably like a day.
Exactly. I was going to say, it probably took it an hour to get through 15,000 iterations. Where, I mean, how long would it take a guy in R&D to be able to do a project like that?
Well, that's definitely a topic to discuss, you know, in the future. Eventually, I want to get a few ball guys on the pod. And, you know, I think a lot of these technologies that have come out, whether it's 3D printing or some of this supercomputing, what it's doing is it's speeding up the prototyping process where they can go from idea to something that they can actually hit. I think it's speeding that up. And what that's doing is it's accelerating the product design cycle so they can come up with more products in a shorter amount of time, test them, and then say, oh, wait a minute, okay, this idea didn't work, this one did. I wasn't aware that 15,000 different iterations before they got to the finish line. But, you know, it's definitely changed the way club designers think about designing golf clubs. using machine learning. And I don't see that being something that's going to go away. I think machine learning is going to become part of all, you know, everybody's daily lives, artificial intelligence, all of the above. So it'll be great to see where all of this stuff goes in the future when it comes to, you know, artificial intelligence and golf.
I'm with you. I think AI is here to stay. All right. Well, with that, let's get to the second half of our interview with Bettinardi Golf founder Bob Bettinardi. He tells quite possibly one of the wildest stories I've ever heard about working with Jim Furyk on the eve of his U.S. Open win at Olympia Fields and what he had to do to get Jim a putter for that week. Here's the interview.
I'd be curious to get your take on how 3D printing is changing what you do.
Without sharing a lot of secrecy, I'll give you an example. I had an idea about 2 months ago. I wanted to make a putter that looks like a hybrid. And
wow.
I had my 3D printer printed out, and he did about three or four versions of it. And to be honest with you, I still don't like it. So instead of me going into the machine, which would cost me $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 to machine something like that, he 3D printed my four versions. Took about 2 hours to 3D print inch version, so it took 8 hours to 3D print, which cost me pretty much almost next to. I mean, I had to buy the 3D printer, of course, which I bought. You know, I replace it every 3 or 4 years, but I was able to look at it without stopping one of my machine tools and stopping one of my CNC machinists. It's so nice to be able to look at it. So aesthetically, because you can't hit the 3D print because it's made out of basically plastic, right? It's not going to be heavy enough.
Right.
But looking at it aesthetically, I hated it, to be honest with you. Even though I thought it was going to be pretty cool, I did not like it. And I showed it to my son. I showed it to a number of different golfers who are very low handicaps. One of them liked it, and the six of them said, yeah. So we nixed it. So that's the beauty of 3D printing. You're able to really come up with anything. I mean, make a putter that looks like a water bottle for all I care. Let's see what it looks like. So, I mean, these are the things that you can go through without stopping that would cost you literally thousands upon thousands of dollars to go ahead and machine something, you know?
You know, you mentioned working with Matt Kuchar. You also work with Fred Couples. You've worked in the past with Jim Furyk. I'm curious, which tour player has had the biggest impact on your designs and maybe kind of pushed you to think outside the box a little bit more?
You know, Kuch is, you know, up until the beginning when we first started with him, he worked with me a ton. He's locked in right now. I mean, what is he, number two or three on the FedEx? You know, he's easily going to be in the President's Cup, probably easily going to be in the Ryder Cup. So he's really locked in. He's a cash machine on the PGA Tour. I would say a guy that comes to me every now and then is Freddie. Freddie just switched putters for the British Senior Open 2 weeks ago. He went to another putter. We're getting a lot of feedback from Eddie Pepperell. We signed him last year. He's a joy to work with. Believe it or not, Hao Tung Lee, he's on our staff. He's the number one Chinese golfer in the world. He's a great guy to work with. We got a couple ladies, Yu Liu, she's on our staff. Some of the web guys are on our staff. I would say, you know, probably one of the biggest guys, Furyk. When Jim was playing our putter on an everyday basis, he was a great guy that we worked with. We had BJ Singh back in, I remember, 2004. He won four tournaments in a row, including the PGA Championship. He was adamant that, you know, a neck had to be a certain way. So throughout the years, I would say, I don't think there's any one specific, you know, I think what these guys want, and they always, what they ask for is they want it yesterday. So if they have an idea, they're like, hey, can I get it next week? And it's like, let me think here. The great thing about Bettinardi Golf is we do have, you know, over 35, 40 machine tools. And usually one or two of them are open, or we're doing something similar to what they want, so we're able to knock it out for them. But yeah, I don't think there's one particular guy. I think they all lend credence. I love it when you get a guy like we've been working with Jason Duffner, we've been working with Luke List, and these guys are, you know, always looking for something very different that we make in our standard tour product. You know, there's really no one guy. There's a lot of guys.
I'm curious, is there a moment that you can remember when you decided that you were ready to go off on your own and start a putter company underneath your own name? And I'm also curious to kind of tie in with that, if you remember a moment where you really felt like that Bettinardi Golf had made it.
2003 at the U.S. Open at Olympia Fields. It was Father's Day weekend, of course. They always have it on Father's Day. But I remember being there on a Wednesday. I was there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Jim Furyk had heard that my facility, my business, was only about 25, 30 minutes away from Olympia Fields Country Club. He came up to me around 11 o'clock that day, 11 a.m., and said, "Hey, I just got notified by the USGA that the putter I'm using now, which was another brand, was deemed illegal. And he said, I need to go get a putter like now." And he goes, "Can I go to your facility and see what you have?" And I said, "Absolutely." So I drove him and his father to my facility. We got there around noon, and he was there till about 8 o'clock that night and picked up a putter called the Baby Ben. And it was a wide body mallet, aluminum. It was actually probably one of the first MOI putters that was ever made. And he ended up using it. He ends up winning the U.S. Open, and so to speak, the rest is history. It was just a great moment for Jim Furyk and huge for the Bettinardi brand.
You know, Bob, I have a question to kind of close out our interview here. What would you advise to the everyday player when they're selecting a putter? I think, you know, most folks, they walk into a golf shop, they kind of pick it up, hit a couple putts, and that's the basic criteria for what they're going to put in play. I'd be curious to get your take and advice, what you would say to the everyday player on how to get the right putter in the bag.
I think we talked about it a few minutes ago, was aesthetic putter. Having something that looks really, really good to your eye. Not just good, but great. Does it look good to you? I remember before I was even in the golf business, and I was not even thinking ever about being in the golf business, and I was on a trip in Myrtle Beach, maybe I was in my early 20s, walking in a golf shop and saw, wow, this putter really looks good. And I ended up buying the putter and playing very well. And if I was the golfer now, I would do the same thing. I'd walk in your local golf shop and say, let me look at the rack of putters that are in there and what looks good to my eye, whether it's a mallet, whether it's face balance, whether it's, I'm a center shaft putter type of a guy. I like center shaft putters. So what looks good, what feel? Once you get the looks, then it's got to go to feel. Immediately, you got to go to feel. If it feels really hard to you or it feels too soft to you, keep going. Find something that feels really good. So looks and feel are the two most important things. Once you get those two things, then you got to go right to your specs, your loft, your lie, and your length, the three L's. Then you need to get fit. And then the last thing would be your grip size. You want a standard grip, a midsize, an oversize, you know, whatever grip that person is thinking of, you know, that fits the hand real well. A lot of people are going to oversized grips. They've all been doing that for years because they want to use the big muscles instead of, you know, maybe having the small muscles at work. You want to use the big muscles, your shoulders. So all that is something, or are all multiple things that go into choosing a putter. You know, one more thing I wanted to say, guys, the other guy that I spent a lot of time with at my facility last year was a guy named Francesco Molinari.
He had a pretty decent season.
He had a great year last year with our product. He won four times, including the British. He absolutely was one of our, just a joy to work with. He was such a gentle soul. He was a guy that was very particular with the, but what he did almost the same thing. He looked at a putter. He goes, "I love this look." And it was our, ended up being a Tour BB0 putter. From there, he got his weight right. He got his length right, his loft, and it picked up a great grip and just got hot. I mean, really hot, you know, he did everything.
Yeah, he's obviously one of the best putters out on tour. You know, it's great to see him having great success with your product.
We lost him this year to a very hefty contract from another golf company, but it was fun for the 1 year we had him, I can tell you that.
Hey, Bob, thank you so much for your time and just kind of telling stories and all your memories. I know you have a lot, and just having celebrated 20 years.
I appreciate it, guys. I thank you very much. Thank you for all your time today, and I hope all goes well. Looking forward to the BMW at Medina, which I'll be at, and the rest of the season.
Special thank you to Bob Bettinardi for being our interview subject last week and this week. Thanks for tuning in to Fully Equipped. See you next week.